Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and this week we have as our guest Rick Martin, who has been a business consultant and real estate broker for 36 years and is an expert on relationships, especially but not limited to business relationships. Today, my goal is to have a practical discussion on universal laws that restore function to relationships that can be seen with measurable results. And Rick focuses on the implementation of whole and complete work that prevents the repetition of destructive patterns. In other words, he gets people unstuck. Rick, welcome to Answers Network.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. I appreciate your having me on as a guest. And I'm gonna do my very best to convey some of the wonderful knowledge that has been imparted to me by people that have mentored me, you know, throughout my adult life.
And I'm looking forward to it as well. Unlike some guests have a lot of books and everything else, so there's a lot for me to go through. In your case, there wasn't as much, so I feel like I'm going to get as much benefit as any of our viewers or listeners. So, Rick, before we delve into the vast world of relationships, share with our audience what led you to study this area so deeply.
You want to start back at the beginning?
Yeah.
As far as leading the concern. So this has been an adult life search. And to be honest with you, I was a high school football player, and I got the bejesus beat out of me. And what that did is it caused me to have some experiences that were not ordinary. And if you look at, if any of you have read about shamanistic, the ability to be able to create shamanistic experiences, a lot of times it's done through physical pain. And, you know, I had a series of injuries where I kept playing and I stopped sleeping. Mm-hmm. And what it did is it propelled me into a different dimension. And I saw a different part of reality. And I'm going to talk about that today.
Good.
And it caused me to study and look for people who had a similar event. And, you know, that was when I was 17 years old. When I was 35 years old, I met a gentleman by the name of Patrick McVeigh, and he was like a second father to me. He was truly the most influential mentor that I had in my life. And he gave clarity and substance to the experience that I had. And it was like going from the third grade to postgraduate school in just a very short time. So give you a little bit of a background, but yes. A lot of the knowledge I have is, if we're dealing with universal law, however you want to describe it, it's absolutely practical. And what I have a practice that enables people to be able to take these laws and use them in very concrete ways. And I bill myself as a mentor. And in fact, Alan, there's two parts to this conversation I'd like to start it with. Whenever I'm introduced to somebody, I get two permissions. The first permission is I ask, do I have permission to be absolutely honest with you?
Absolutely.
And you have permission to be absolutely honest with me. If I say anything, I can't do anything because I'm remote. But if I say or do anything that offends you, please tell me and I'll apologize. Okay. But sometimes the reason we ask for permission like that is that when you're doing genuinely pointed counseling or coaching, if you want to put it that way, it can hit a sore point. So you got to get people ready for it. You can't just blast them up the side of their head and say, "Oh, by the way, do you know that?" It's like one of the things I talk about is, you know, when all those bad things happen to you, who was the one person that was there every time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it was you. Yep. So maybe you ought to take a look at that. Okay, the second permission I ask is I'm going to ask you to in today's parlance, to coach you, but I'm really going to mentor you because there's a difference between the two.
Yeah, and if you can, share the difference.
Well, when you're mentoring somebody, it's a dialogue. And when you're coaching somebody, it's like you're coming from a point of authority, and the authority is, I know better than you, and you need to do what I say. And when I work with people, when I mentor people, I say, look, I'm going to give you my perspective from the standpoint of my experience and my knowledge. Okay. And what I want you to do is I want you to have an open mind, and I want you to either believe me or disbelieve me, but you need to try it on, because the real learning that takes place when you're acquiring any kind of wisdom, which is what I sought when I, from those times, I sought wisdom and understanding of what the heck happened to me and how the world really works. And what it amounts to is you have to gain experience until you can have all of the book learning or the repetition of things. It's just like memorizing stuff for a test. If you memorize stuff for a test, you don't own it. If you study something, if you make mistakes, if you have to go back and correct your mistakes, what happens is you end up owning stuff to your marrow. Mm-hmm. And as evidence, I'm sorry, sometimes I get a little long-winded here, Alan. But
No, that's
10,000 hours. You guys heard the theory of 10,000 hours. When 10, you spend, like the Beatles spent 10,000 hours in Germany, and they were a good band when they left England. When they came back from England, they were crack. And they were absolute expert. And so if you spend the time at something, you own it. I can stand up the stuff that I know. I have a specialized area of knowledge, and I don't need notes. I don't need books. I may need a reminder of, you know, I gave you some possible categories to talk to, but I own this stuff, and I owe that to Patrick McVeigh, who's since passed to the great beyond. But I mean, when you see, it's the difference. I served an apprenticeship with him, and mm-hmm. you schlep for the master, and you absorb him. And so what you're going to see is the level of ground of being, and what you're going to see a lot of is Mr. McVeigh.
Well, one of the areas that you touched on with this has to do with common denominators. And I love that. And as you were talking about that, and it also touches in that area about being authentic with people, to where, you know, you're asking permission. And it's interesting, you know, you had said that, you know, that when you met my son, that he said that we're very similar. I'm seeing it right now, because that's one of the things that I've done in consulting with families is I would ask again permission, obviously, as you did, you know, to be brutally honest if necessary. And many times they would go through and they would start telling me all the situations. And I would say essentially what you just said, what's the common denominator in this?
Yeah.
And sometimes they'd get mad at me. Well, are you saying that this is all about me? Are you blaming me? No, I just asked you a question. Sounds like you might be, but anyway, So,
and that's an interesting topic that you brought up there, the difference between blame and responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you followed it up with, I'm not here to blame you, but I am here to have you take responsibility for the way your life shows up.
Right.
And that's a hard thing for people to get. And they're saying, whatever's in your life is just a reflection of who you are. Mm-hmm. And that is really, because it all boils down to responsibility and authenticity, as you said. And it's hard. People in the culture that we live in, we're not taught, and we don't have permission to be authentic. We always have to play a role, and we develop these identities that oftentimes are not real. And when you have that unreality, you breed dysfunction. And we'll get into that, because one of the ways I bill myself when I talk to people in business is I do dispute resolution. And I tell them I have expertise in the nature of enemy and treason in business. And they go, what? I mean, who talks about that? I don't know of anybody else that talks about that. And but I found it necessary, because people do not understand that. Well, first of all, I'm a professional negotiator, first and foremost, whether it's doing real estate or whether it's doing business deals or resolving disputes. I look at life as everything's a negotiation. Mm-hmm. And when you have to understand negotiation, you have to understand there's the content of a situation and the context of a situation. The content is the immediate form, right? And the context are the background rules. And unless you understand that, to put it simply, like if you're talking about a football game, mm-hmm. the content might be that, you know, North High is playing South High and Jimmy Jones is playing quarterback for South High. And you know, and it's the game is on Friday night at 7 o'clock, right? The context mm-hmm. are there's 11 men per side. And this, the field is 100 yards long with 10 yard end zones and 53 and a half yard wide or whatever. And you see, whoever controls the rules of a situation controls the form. And I'll give you another example of that. It's very important to understand this. To like right now, I'm giving you a lecture. See, I'm playing teacher. You're playing student right now. Mm-hmm. And see, so I may or may not be qualified to do that, but I can certainly take on the being of that. Mm-hmm. And anyway, but here's another example of form and function and context. So let's talk about shoes. So Alan, how many different kinds of shoes are there? Name a couple different kinds of shoes.
Tennis shoes, dress shoes, high heels,
cowboy boots, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I my parents never bought me a horse when I was a kid, so I learned how to ride when I got old enough to do that. And I love cowboy boots, and they're not very good for hiking in. You better right. get some hiking boots, right? And even if you get hiking boots, if you're in the desert, maybe not so good. You may want to wear sandals. So here's an example where the environment dictates the form of the shoe. And each shoe is, you know, if you wear snowshoes, it's a good thing to have in Norway in the middle of winter, right? Not maybe so much in, you know, hiking the trails of Southern California.
Right.
See, so there's a form versus function kind of situation that it's really imperative as a base piece of knowledge to understand. And we'll get further into that, but to control the context of a situation, you need to learn how to ask the right questions, and this is the Socratic method, and that's a lot of what I do is that's how you can get people to it holds up a mirror when I'm working with a person in order to be able to determine the content of their own thoughts. And a lot of times the content of their own thoughts is not necessarily consistent with the other. And you have people that are not single-minded. Anyway, but I'm tending to wander a little bit.
No, that's okay. And but also, I mean, it, as you were saying that, I started thinking that a lot of this is based on what a person's perspective is.
Absolutely correct.
You know, and so and personally, I've often said that our perspectives are very important as to how we see the world. Or how we see our life, but how does your system allow people to change their perspective if their perspective keeps taking them down the wrong path?
Okay. Well, the very first step is to realize that you actually have a perspective, okay, and mm-hmm. that you have a point of view, mm-hmm. and you have to understand that people walk into situations depending on their identity, right? Mm-hmm. And for instance, if I'm a surgeon, they give an example. Surgeons tend to think of everything in terms of an operation. So right. I know you have a lot of alternative health people on, and if I break my arm, I'm going to a Western doctor. If I have other issues, I may not want to go there because I don't believe in the drugs, you know, the pharmaceuticals. I'm just giving you a value judgment.
Yeah.
And I think that your network is consistent with a lot of that.
Yes, it is.
And anyway, but the point of it being is when the other way to describe it is if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm.
So if, like, for instance, if I'm an insurance salesman and I'm always on and I'm wearing the hat of an insurance salesman, I'm always going to look at people as a prospect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you my intentions for the day. I want to introduce myself to people, and people will make a judgment as to whether I have anything viable or not, because there's two things I'm looking for. First thing is I'm looking for people that I can mentor, because I am dedicated to passing on the knowledge that I have to future generations. I have been privileged to spend the time with some really brilliant people and people with heart, and it's sorely missing. So that's one of the things I'm willing to teach people what I know, and not necessarily for money. because money is not for everything. Other types of people, that so there are some people out there that may need me. If they're having a disputes type situation, they may need me desperately. And I'll give some examples of some of the stuff that I've done in those realms, in terms of applying the knowledge that I have to real life situations.
Well, let's talk about some examples in that area, because as you were mentioning it, one of the thoughts I had was, I'm a firm believer of mediation versus lawsuits. And yet we're the most litigious country in the world, and then you take it from there, and then California then becomes the most litigious state. We're on a whole different platform than most of the world. Let's talk about how we can shift to a more mediation-related way of going about things, because it just seems like it's just gotten out of control.
Well, let me just tell you this, that you're absolutely correct. In my opinion, lawyers are oftentimes necessary. So I'll give you a recent example that I dealt with.
Sure.
I had a situation where a client owned a house. And if you've ever seen in certain areas of Southern California, you have hilly areas where builders have built homes where mm-hmm. one home will be at a higher level than the other, right? So my client has a higher elevation home than the other client, right? And mm-hmm. part of this home at the lower level is halfway in the ground. If you've ever seen that, where you have these zero lot lines and the home is buried 4 foot mm-hmm. of its from its foundation up underground. Right. And there's literally dirt right up against the wall. And this house develops a leak, right? And she mm-hmm. says, it's your fault. It's your client. It's his job. The runoff from his, the fact that he tiled his backyard is causing runoff and it's causing my house to leak. Well, I got brought into this situation, and needless to say, there's already lawyers involved because my clients got sued. And
sure.
And they brought me on as a project manager because of my background in real estate. I've done a lot of builds and I've project managed all kinds of commercial real estate, residential real estate, flips, those kind of things. Anyway, so I started to talk to them and I tried to have a conversation with these people and ended up talking to the lawyer. I told my client, you have to hire a lawyer. I brought in a firm that I totally trust. And I said, you can't have these speculations without knowing what's going on. Because, you know, I have quite a bit of experience with the fact that there's underground water flow. And this mm-hmm. particular house is at the confluence of two hills. You have two hills above the properties, and the valley, like, aimed the underground water flow right at this house that was submerged, halfway underground.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to my client, you need to be responsible for this. And he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, until you can expose that wall, the owner is not smart enough. They're blaming you. I said, dig it out. And so he did. He ended up paying like $5,000 out of his own pocket. And we dug the trench and we opened it up. And lo and behold, the underground water, the underground retaining wall is devoid of any kind of waterproofing.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, and when we did that, the attorney, I mean, she brings her attorney out and he measures it and this. And I point out plainly, I said, look, the reason it's leaking is it's been 35 years underground and the darn thing isn't waterproofed anymore. And mm-hmm. you would have a rubberized surface that looks like black tar and you would have a plastic sheeting. That's how this is done. I showed him pictures of it. And what happened was the guy got embarrassed. And then a week later, the woman sold the property. It was like, here's this lawsuit. And all of a sudden she just bails out and sold it to some other guy who was a flipper. We explained the situation to the flipper and the flipper fixed it and sewed it up. And now it's done.
I was going to say, as you were saying that, and one of the things I think a lot of listeners don't know about me is that the waterproofing you're talking about, I used to do as a teenager. My father owned a roofing company, yeah. And he was the one that was doing what you're doing. He would be brought in as the consultant that would come in and say, here's your problem, and you need to now dig a trench here and waterproof and so on and so forth. So you sort of took me back to my teenage years of being in one of those narrow little trenches and yeah. spraying everything and coming home completely covered. So, yes, we've done a lot of things. But it still sounds like, and again, and when I was saying that about how litigious everything is, I mean, I work for a lot of attorneys. There's certainly a place for attorneys. I'm just saying that there are so many things that if we can mediate these things first, that a lot of the problems are going to go away before people go out and each get an attorney who, in some cases, may be fueling the flames to make sure that this continues. And yeah, so on.
It spins in circles. And that's what had happened before I got there. See, I unstuck right. it. By doing that, I unstuck it. It was spinning in circles and they were arguing back and forth and it was all hypothetical. I said, well, we don't need to be hypothetical. We need to be practical. Yeah. I have another one of my favorite stories. One of my.
Please. I'll tell you what. So we're going to take a break. But okay. when we come back, give me just a little teaser on this story that people will come right back to hear.
Okay, so this is a story about how Rick and Brian saved the world.
I love it. Okay. So you can't want to miss this one. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We are speaking with Rick Martin, and we're talking about relationships. And relationships are everything. Think about your life. Everything about your life has to do with your relationship in one way or another. Now, when we went to break, Rick was about to tell us how he saved the world. Rick, tell us.
Not alone. I had my friend and my adopted spiritual son, Brian, to assist. Okay. So here's what happened. I got referred to Brian. One of my mentors, his name is Jim Dawn, Dr. Jim Dawn. He's a chiropractor and a heli worker. And he's somebody I'm going to recommend that you bring on your show. You would love this man. And heli work is deep tissue body massage like Rolfing. And if you know anything about that. But anyway, Jim refers me. He said, this young man, he said he needs a mentor. And I said, well, I'll meet him. Let's see what he can do. So I meet the kid, and he's 26 years old. He's a lieutenant in the Air Force, and he's in charge of satellite launches. I could not believe the responsibility that a young guy like this had in terms of doing the logistics for setting up these the military satellite launches for, you know, spy satellites and weather satellites and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he calls me up one day. And he says, Rick, I got a big problem at work. And I said, well, what's that? He said, the gyroscopes in a major portion of the satellites that are in orbit right now are failing. And I said, okay. And he said, what's the problem? He said, nobody's doing anything about it. And one thing about the military is it is very unforgiving. You cannot make a mistake. And therefore you have sometimes it ends up there's, forgive me, there's a lot of responsible parts about the military, and I'm pro-military. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about organizations, sometimes there's a dysfunction where people are hesitant to take a stand to really dig in and find out what the issues are. And he said, He said the colonels, the generals above me, nobody's willing to tackle the problem. And I said, okay. I said, I got good news and bad news for you. And he and they're both the same. And he says, well, what's that? I said, you're responsible. He goes, what? And he blew up at me. I said, you're responsible. He goes, I'm a lousy lieutenant. I said, you don't understand. I said, do you know why you're responsible? He said, no. I said, because you're the one that cares.
Yep.
And I said, responsibility is literally the ability to respond. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you some information. So the first thing I'm going to ask you is, do you know anything about gyroscopes? He said, no. I said, now ask me. He says, Rick, do you know anything about gyroscopes? And I said, hell no. I said, but I'm a really good manager. And I said, Brian, do you think it would be a good idea to find a gyroscope expert? He goes, I can do that. I said, I know who to ask. I said, find the best gyroscope expert in the country. And he goes out and finds top two, right? I said, next thing. I said, you have to understand, when you're in a position in an institution with power and somebody above you knows less than you and perhaps is less motivated than you, you have to do what's called managing up. Mm-hmm. And you have to respect their authority, but you do it by, I said, I asked him another question. I said, do you care about getting the credit for this? He said, no. I said, by the time we're done, your boss, the colonel, and his boss, the general, are going to get credit for this. I said, I'm going to teach you how to be a ghost.
Yeah. And you know, as you were saying that, the thought going through my mind was, if you cannot approach this from the standpoint that if it goes well, somebody higher up's going to take credit for it. And if it goes bad, it's all on you. Right. And if you can't accept that going in, it's going to be a tough road.
Right.
Right.
I said, now, Brian, I said, you have to formulate everything in terms of the question. So you make suggestions by asking questions to your colonel. And it goes a little like this. This is, I'm giving you obviously the abridged version. Colonel, sir, do you think it would be a good idea to have some gyroscope experts at our next meeting? Yeah, Pendergast, that's a good idea. Make sure that happens. See, now it becomes the colonel's order, right? Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they invite these two gyroscope experts to the meeting. They explain the situation. They think about it and they go, did it. It's a software problem. And this is how you correct it. And they corrected it. And everybody's walking out going, God, that's the best meeting we've had in 5 years. And Brian's laughing as all this is happening. So my claim to fame, and let's see if you guys get this. There's a woman in a trailer park in Arkansas that's not going to get the money for when the space junk hit it. Anyway, so that's a story about how we saved the world from all those satellites falling out of orbit.
Falling, yes, in some random places around Absolutely. The world. I'm looking at the time and I'm realizing that there is so much more I'm going to want to go. So I'd love to have you come back and we can go into more areas. I just want to say that now because I'm going to run through some of the things.
Okay, I have go ahead and then you go ahead and I would love to come back because I have a lot to say.
Yes, and I appreciate that. So as I was doing my due diligence, I came mm-hmm. across some very interesting things, one of which is where you have said that there's only 5 games in the world.
That's correct.
My question is, why 5 and what are they?
Well, the reason why 5 is because that's how many there are. Well, that's how many I've discovered so far. Okay. There may be more, but maybe I don't know about them. And what they are is this. This is one of the most important things I teach. When you understand negotiation and relationships, so there's the first game is called win-win. And when you play win-win in your life, you have an equitable exchange of energy for the mutual benefit of all parties. It's called reciprocity. Yep. And God made the universe like this. So let me give you a simple example. Plants breathe in carbon dioxide and they breathe out oxygen. And animals breathe in oxygen and they breathe out carbon dioxide. They are perpendicular to one another. They support one another. And the very best relationships that we can have are if we construct those type of relationships where they're mutually beneficial to all parties. And it's called teamwork. Yep. Right? Okay, now we're going to degenerate a little bit. So the next situation is called win-lose. There's two forms of win-lose. One is I win, you lose, which is persecution. Yep. Right? And that's where people take advantage of another. They bully, they lie, they cheat, they steal, whatever. And then the other person becomes the victim. Now, conversely, you have to have a person cooperating on the other end. And conversely, there's a situation called I lose, you win, which is called self-sacrifice or martyrdom. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, a lot of people, every persecutor has to have a victim, and they get enmeshed in this. There's a really great book called The Games People Play by Byrne from the 60s. And he explains this stuff. It's part of transactional analysis type of psychotherapy. And these games are vicious, and they degenerate down ordinarily into lose-lose situations. And of course, lose-lose, which is the fourth game, is the situation where you have the suicide bomber, where he's willing to blow himself up and kill you and take you with him. And these are the areas of dysfunction when I come into a situation and I can analyze what's being played right here. And also, this victim, persecutor, and rescuer type triangle is the cornerstone of addictive type situations, whether it's drugs or alcohol or shopping or whatever, right?
Yep.
And this is why things spin in circles. And we can get into it a little further on another occasion, but you have to either ratchet it up to playing win-win, and people have mm-hmm. to stop playing these destructive games. The fifth game. So Alan, so I got a great a business proposition. So let's get a couple of ski masks and a couple of Saturday night specials and rob gas stations and make money. Would you like to play that game with me?
Nope.
Okay. So the fifth game is no game. So if you're presented with a game, I want everybody to understand, anytime they enter a relationship, people are saying, look, here I am. This is who I am. Who are you? Would you like to play with me? And if you find out that the rules or the context are beneficial to who you are, and it's a good match, then you play, right? If it's an equitable mm-hmm. exchange, okay. But otherwise, you say no game. I'm not playing. And I will venture to assert that probably 15-20% of the population right now is, call them what you will, call them psychopaths, call them sociopaths, call them narcissists.
Yeah.
And they're nuts, and you can't play with them because you can't win with them, because they're always going to enter up. They're always looking for an angle, and they're lying. They're not playing authentic and being straight up with what they have a hidden agenda. That's a whole nother subject we can talk about, is hidden agendas and how to discern them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a dangerous world out there. And it's my intention to equip people with a proper knowledge so that they can tell who's lying and who isn't.
Well, I think that's a great way for us to go into that a little bit, in regards to, how do we know, we now are in a situation to where, we can watch TV and we can look at politicians that sit up there and just lie to us over and over and over again. How do we differentiate this? Because, we have this happening, but yet half the people are believing one side, although it may very well be a lie. You've got half the people that are not believing them, but yet they're believing somebody else. And that may not necessarily be the truth either.
Okay.
So, give us a couple of tools that might be able to make us be able to.
Here's the ultimate tool. Okay.
Yeah.
The universe is a perfect feedback system. And when I'm working with a situation, I care about 2% what people say, and I care 98% about what they do. And that's the invisible context part of it. And the old fable, the emperor has no clothes?
Yep.
Well, you have to be willing to be able to say the emperor has no clothes, and you can point out about what a person is doing. And it's just, It's as simply as saying is, I don't really like to handle Sharpies, but, you know, in fact, I never touch them. I mean, this is a silly example, but as I sit here holding a Sharpie, you know that I'm lying. Mm-hmm. Wherever my camera is, I can't get it in the center. Anyway, if you just look at what people are doing there's a process called as-is-ing. There's a process called verbal judo, mm-hmm. where you ask the right questions, and what you'll see is that people that are lying, they're always making up one lie or another, and they're never consistent. So mm-hmm. you can look for their consistency between their speech, because they'll tell the same story, right? They won't alter it. Now, the police do this. You have a detective background. Is that right? We'll have to talk about that sometime, mm-hmm. because I've ended up becoming a detective. It's just what I do. And I have stories about that too. It's just part and parcel of discovering the truth. But anyway, the point of it being is the final arbiter is what people do. And right. you have to have the courage to be able to see it and not, let me talk about perspective and blinders. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just assert something is that, I'm stupid. And you're stupid, but thank God, not all the time. And some of that stupidity, I'm not talking about people that are special needs. I'm talking about conditioning. So I'm going to tell you another quick story. So back when I was younger, I had a souped up Integra. It had a race kit on it. It was really fun to drive. And my usual routine was if I had an appointment, I'd go out, I'd open the door, and I would pop the seat forward, put my briefcase in back, put the seat back in place, and drive off. So the Integra's in the shop, and I have this loaner car, right? And I go down, and I got plenty of time to get to my appointment, right? And I open the door, and I look for the little lever to pop the seat forward. And, oh, well, this is a different car. I can't find the lever. How do I pop the seat forward? And I'm looking, I'm pushing, I'm pulling, and I swear to God, I don't know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes looking for this. I look in the glove compartment because some of the times, you know, the old cars, they'd have a switch in the glove compartment that did something, a button, whatever. And the darn seat is stuck, and it's stuck. And I can tell you, I'm an old football player, and I have a temper. And I literally started swearing a blue streak. I was so angry and upset and frustrated, right? And I literally hop, hop, hop backwards. And I looked at the car, Alan, it was a four-door car. And I just started laughing at myself. And I go, what an idiot. But because I was so conditioned to my routine, and right. I was unconscious thinking about the appointment and what I was going to do, I literally could not see until I changed my perspective and I had a bigger view of the car. Now, I could have turned my head, but I couldn't. Because I was looking straight ahead and I could only see the door on the driver's side. So there's an example of stupidity. So I'll give you one more.
I don't know that it's necessarily stupidity, as I think it's more of a conditioning and focus.
But it is a conditioning. But in my opinion, it's a stupidity because you can't learn, because you're doomed to repeat the same mistake over and over again. Because of the conditioning. So a lot of the learning that has to take place in life, you have to unlearn something first, mm-hmm. or you have to at least put it aside. See, it's not necessarily bad to have another example would be in the U.S., we all drive on the right-hand side. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in England, they drive on the left-hand side.
Right.
But the background context of it is that everybody has an agreement on which side to drive on in order to be safe. Mm-hmm. But you can't transfer one to the other, you see? So it's very good to have that conditioning here, but if you go over there and you're stuck with your conditioning and you can't relearn, you're in an accident.
Well, you just mentioned in regards to unlearning, and I think that's going to lead us into one of the other areas. So I know that within your work, you focus on the four steps of success. You also stop on the four stops of success. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, for everybody out there, Rick's going to share with us the four steps to success, but also the four stops to success. Right. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network. Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. West Shield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. West Shield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child. This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. West Shield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step. And we're back. We're talking with Rick Martin, and we are talking about, now we're going to go into talking about success. So Rick, share with us your four steps to success and follow that up with your four stops to success.
Absolutely. So this is the lecture as given to me by Patrick McVeigh. So there are four steps to success. Number one is to show up. I guarantee you, if you do not show up for things, you will not be successful. Okay. Mm-hmm. That one's real simple and straightforward. And number two is to pay attention. And a lot of times what happens is most people are so full of themselves, they forgot how to pay attention and be the observer. So it means you need to look and listen. You need to observe what's going on, and you need to be able to describe it. And in order to do that, you have to let go of your own agenda. You have to actually say, well, you know what? I don't know what's going on. Let me just see what's plain and simple. Just like the little fable about the little boy that said the emperor has no clothes. He didn't have any prejudice. He wasn't trying to gain favor with the emperor. He wasn't trying to pretend that he was an enlightened being that could see these invisible, fine spiritual clothing. But he just the emperor's got no clothes. So be the observers. A lot of times it's just the simple, straightforward. You can see the actual series of relationships and what people are actually doing. Never mind. You put aside what they say and you observe what they're doing. Okay. Number three is to tell the truth. And there's two forms of the truth. There's intellectual truth, which is the ability to report facts accurately. A lot of times people don't know how to report facts. They inject their opinion into mm-hmm. situations. So you have to learn the difference between facts and opinions. And then the second part of the truth is the emotional truth. And that's the ability to actually be in touch with your own emotions. And nowadays, it's very difficult because a lot of emotions are not allowed. And I would venture to say that God gave us different emotions to handle different things. And this behooves a longer lecture, but I'll just touch on a couple things. Mm-hmm. If you have anger, the proper use of anger is the ability to create proper boundaries in your life so that when somebody trespasses on you, tries to mm-hmm. dominate and control or force rules of engagement, which you don't want to play, the anger says, stop, I'm not playing that game. Right. And grief, the proper use of grief is to be able to say goodbye when you suffered a loss. So It's how to be able to say goodbye and to be able to be appreciative and honor the relationship. Like if somebody dies or if there's a breakup in a relationship, you have to honor it because what you do is cry. And what happens in a lot of families is we are not given permission. Certain families will have prohibitions against some families are not allowed to be angry. Some people are, you're not allowed to cry, right? And what happens is unless you can identify both the facts of the situation and how you feel about it exactly, you're doomed to repeat it and get stuck, right? Mm-hmm. So once you've done the first three steps, the fourth is the hardest, and that's don't be attached to the outcome. And this actually has to do a lot with faith, where all I care about, if I do my job correctly, all I care about is finding out what the truth is. And it's the truth that actually remedies the situation, like with the wall. The truth became plain in the sense that the waterproofing, because it's cement is porous. The reason your wall leaks is that there's no waterproofing on it. Right. I was like, I didn't have to. It wasn't Rick Martin's opinion. It was the truth that the darn wall leaked because of that. And the problem went away. Okay. Now let's go to the four stops to success. Now this is the first four steps are actually fairly well known. Four stops are almost unknown. Okay. The first one is called barriers, and barriers are time and money. You'll hear people put up, I don't have enough time and I don't have enough money. And that's because they don't understand what time and money is. So first of all, time-wise, everybody has 24/7 and you're spending your time on something, but it means whatever your priority is, you're not willing to spend it on it. Yeah. Okay. Now money is, what makes a paper bill or a piece of silver or whatever valuable? Well, it's agreement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people don't understand the nature of money. And money is based on, like, if I want to build a house, I have paper money, but I can engage people with skills. I've got carpenters, I've got cement people, and I can command their knowledge and their skill in order to put that together, right? Yep. So your knowledge and your skills are valuable. They're a form of currency. So a lot of times you need to understand that you don't have to. Like if I want to go to college and I say, well, I don't have the money. Well, what are the solutions? Well, I can go to junior college and I can I can get 2 years worth of education, right? And where it doesn't cost a lot of money, right? Or I can get a scholarship, or I can take 2 years off and work and earn enough money to be able to pay for my tuition. There's always these and situations where instead of just quitting and saying, well, I don't have any money. Well, how do you convert your knowledge and your skills into something that is exchangeable? And you can barter in life. People, their money is not the end all of things.
Exactly. Now, before we go any further, I want to, for everybody out there, so that's the first of the four stops. Rick, what I'd like you to do is, because we've got a question coming in from somebody, for those people that would like to hear the other three, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
If you go to my website or if you publish my cell phone number, I'm happy to talk to anybody. I have a website that I left with you guys.
Okay.
And it's martinadvisorsgroup.com. martinadvisorsgroup.com.
Okay. And it's I have Martin Advisory Group. Is that
Advisory?
Correct?
Yes, that one too.
Okay.
Yes, who's that one?
Okay. I want to make sure we didn't have it wrong because that's probably what we'll put.
Yes, that's the one. That is the correct one.
Okay. And so if you're driving out there and you want to get a hold of Rick, don't worry about writing this down. We'll put it in the show notes. But again, that's martinadvisorygroup.com. If you go to that, you'll be able to, they can reach you from there without us putting a cell phone.
Yeah, my phone number is on there. They can type in their name and contact information.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. So we've only got about a minute. So let me get to this. This question reads, as a parent of two teenagers, I've been appalled at the indoctrination of our children in the public school system. I have recently shifted them to homeschooling because of this. I don't know what I'm going to do when and if they go to college. What are your thoughts on this? And this is from Sharon in Madison, Wisconsin.
A really tough question, and one that involves, I don't know if I can answer it in a minute. So whatever your children go in, they need to know and understand their own values. And this is not about beliefs. When a child and young people, teenagers, understand their core values, they have to understand the nature of indoctrination and how people will assault their values. And if a person grows up with a ground of being, when you raise a child, you want to raise them to be capable and competent. And you release more and more responsibility. As they demonstrate their ability to be responsible, you can release more and more freedom to them. And it's really hard. If you haven't done that job up to this point, it's hard to get it.
I think that covers it. And again, thank you, Rick. Because that's what it is. It's a matter of did you set the values that are there for them? And I know that one of my sons went to college and he called me 5 weeks in and said, "Dad, this is indoctrination, but I can recognize it for what it is. I'm still going to focus on getting an education." So because of his inner strength, he could recognize it and yet knew that it wasn't going to change him as a person. So
very good.
I agree with you, Rick. Rick, again, thank you so much for coming on. And again, after this, I'd love for us to get together and love to have you back. I think this is such great information. And it's, folks, it's something that all of us can use in our everyday life. It isn't just our business decisions, but it's every part of our life has to do with our relationships. So again, Rick, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Alan. Have that woman call me. I'll finish it.
Okay. Well, what I would say is that let's just have her go to the website.
Yeah, go to the website. Yeah, that's
yeah, fine. And then she can get a hold of you.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome. Thank you. Sure. And for everybody out there, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you click the like button. And if you're interested in seeing more content like this, make sure you subscribe. You can also check out the show through our website. You can do it on our YouTube channel. The website is answers.network, or you can find us on any major platform. For everybody out there, be good human beings. Be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.